Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I want to call this meeting to order. It is our fourth session this evening, and the only announcement that I have is that the district attorney will not be appearing this evening, and she and her budget will be presented on Monday evening after the county attorney, I believe. Is that how we've done that? Okay. So right now we have Mike Hall and from the airport, and Roxanne is sitting in the audience. And welcome, Mike, and go ahead. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you all and go through a budget we worked hard to put together, a document that we think meets the requirements of the airport and at the same time is respectful of the climate that we have right now for air service, which is a significant portion of the airport activity. I would remind you that we are the busiest airport in the southern tier, but we have somewhat less air service than Elmira and a little bit more than Binghamton. So our program here is a more balanced program, not focused entirely on air service, but that's the thing that everybody's interested in. This is what our budget proposal looks like, and it includes an item. First of all, let me tell you that it's balanced, and as you see, it's a 5.18% increase in terms of real money. The program expense that's shown of $144,000 is a projection by our airline consultant. We hope it's a good projection, but this, of course, is a journey, and it's way early. If any of us knew where we would be 15 months from now, we'd be pretty much in demand. So it's best to look at this budget without that figure associated with it, and we'll certainly update you along the way as we go through the year and see if it materializes. The other point I would make is we're in the second year of the three-year waiver of the county administrative charge to the airport, 125.9. Dooley, were you able to get your question answered?
No.
We may have to get back to you then, because I don't have that kind of detail at at my fingertips. No full-time equivalent changes at the airport, but considerable change within the full-time equivalents. One of the things we agreed to last year was to take a portion of the 125.9 and apply it to a change in personnel services that had increased because of reclassification. It had been a number of years since we'd looked at the job descriptions at the airport, and that, along with some other personnel management changes, I believe are working out really well for us. In addition, we've got some equipment issues that we've had to address. There was not, for the years that we were declining in terms of airline service, there wasn't money put away for some of the strategic maintenance items or invested for some of the strategic maintenance items. And so we've got an aging fleet of vehicles that we have to deal with, and we've got a plan to do it, which is pretty good, and I'll talk to you about that a little bit later. And then lastly, we need to be able to get out there and mix it up with the community, particularly the airline community, to get the information and contacts that we're going to need to turn this whole thing around. And that's worked out pretty well for us. I was at the New York Aviation Management Association conference in Rochester last week, and one of the key people from Delta Airlines came and spoke to us, and I had a great conversation with him, and I consider that to be a hopeful small step in our effort to improve the air service up here. So here's a snapshot. As you may not be aware, but the rapid decline in air service has plateaued, leaving us with not as many flights but very high load factors. And that's a bit of a mixed bag. If you think back to Economics 101, if there's a fixed number of flights and the load factor is high on those flights, there's not much to work with from the consumer's point of view. until we get more capacity. The next thing we continue to struggle with is poor service reliability. We are actively seeking new hub destinations because two of our three destinations, which are all three of our destinations are hubs, Newark and Philadelphia, are very difficult hubs.
You're back about 6 inches. It works best.
Okay. I thought maybe, I thought I had to get closer. I've been leaning in. Thank you, Mike. Customer loyalty is a big focus for us. And there's some things I'll get into with regard to customer loyalty. And then we've really doubled down on management to contain costs and try to work the airport into a situation where it's more sustainable. And I'll talk to those points. Okay, so you know airline service is down 25% over the past few years. And we stabilized this year with high load factors. All of this relates back to my friend and mentor, Alfred Kahn, who in 1978 took a leave from Cornell, went down to deregulate the airline industry. Now, prior to 1978, the government dictated service to communities. And there were some good things about that and some not so good things about it. Post-deregulation, there's some good things about that and some things that aren't so good about it. Unfortunately, post-deregulation, we're on the short end of the stick right now. The mainline carriers are businesses. They own certain assets, airplanes, reservation systems, and they will invest those assets where they think they'll get the biggest return on the dollar. That has resulted in them focusing on their core business for obvious reasons. It's much more profitable for United Airlines to fly 400 people behind two pilots from Los Angeles to New York than it is to fly 40 people behind two pilots from Ithaca to New York. And that's the reality of business that we have to struggle against. And it's not just us. It's everybody that's not on a main route between two hubs, has to scramble for whatever service is left. And it's tough because the feeder routes have pretty well been discounted. I was in the brand new American Airlines Operations Center in Fort Worth a couple weeks ago. It's amazing. 115,000 square feet. That's, you know, almost 3 acres worth of space and all networked and display screens and terribly impressive. And I said, wow, this is really cool. You should be able to keep track of everything in the United in the American Airlines system with this. And they said, yes, we can. And I said, including your contract carriers? And they said, oh, no, we don't monitor them. And that tells you exactly where we are in the struggle because the contract carriers, of course, are brought on board by the major airline with the notion that they want to get the most bang for their buck, which means that the squeeze is on the contract carriers, and you can see where it goes from there. The other thing, we have no fix for the Northeast Corridor. Newark and Philadelphia are unreliable hubs on a relative scale, and that's not going to get better. And it doesn't matter whether you're leaving from Syracuse, Rochester, Ithaca, Binghamton, Elmira. Elmira doesn't have service to Newark, but the same reliability exists over each of those legs, and it's not very good, and it's not going to get better. So our strategy is to find hubs that work better. And most recently, we applied for a small community air service grant, which unfortunately we didn't receive, but it was focused on Chicago service to get us connections westbound toward the Pacific Rim, where much of our market wants to go. Ithaca is a boutique market. It's a boutique market in the fact that there are few communities our size that have the need for the global connection that we do, and particularly the need for the connection to the Pacific Rim, because if you look at the demographics of Cornell, when I graduated in 1968, and I went to graduation last year when our adopted Chinese daughter, that's in quotes, we didn't meet her till she was a freshman, graduated. And it's just a completely different face on Cornell University. So what we have to do is make sure the airlines understand how critical this connection is and how profitable it can be to them. And it's an easy mistake. When I talked to Delta last week, I talked to a regional salesperson, and I said, we want to get together with you and Cornell and talk about Delta becoming a global connection for Cornell University because they have a lot of travel needs. And, you know, this is a standard entree. Let's sit down and talk and see if there's some business there. And she said, oh, yeah, Jim so-and-so is our sports guy. And I said, no, we're not talking about sports teams traveling. We're talking about a major institution that needs reliable travel in order to conduct its business on a global basis. Then their vice president for customer satisfaction was there, and I talked to him about it. He got it right away. There's a lot of money in this market, and we use the word Cornell regularly, but it's much more than Cornell. It's really, but people understand Cornell because it's the biggest employer in central New York. It's also Ithaca College. It's also BorgWarner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of money here if an airline would step up and give us the kind of service that we think is supportable as a business case. So we're looking for new hubs, more service to Detroit, Chicago, Charlotte. All those places are of interest to us. And, by the way, they're of interest to Syracuse and Elmira and Binghamton and everybody else. So we have to make the case that we are that boutique market that has the second flight profitability that maybe the other destinations or origins don't have. Okay, customer loyalty. We live in the world of the great ticket exchange. This is one of the pluses of deregulation. You can go on the Internet today, and the cheapest ticket may be from Ithaca. And 2 hours from now, it may be from Binghamton. And after that, it may be from Elmira. So shopping is easy, but finding what you're looking for is not so easy. It's not so easy because the airlines believe that 2 hours is the distance that you will drive to get on their airplane. And so they actually load level between the airports. So Ithaca's got a relatively, Tompkins County has a relatively affluent population compared to some of our surrounding counties. And we have just so many seats. And so you go back to that old supply-demand curve, and we can charge people in flying out of Ithaca a little bit more. Hard to get around that. And besides which, that's particularly useful if Binghamton's sitting at 25% on a flight with a few days to go, watch the bargains come out of Binghamton. Because the Southern Tier airports are all the same from the eye of the airport manager. And then you get into the squeeze play. I've got 50 seats to sell. Okay? I want an 80% load factor. That's 40% or 40 people on the airplane. How much can I charge and still get 40 people on the airplane? Because I'm not yet ready to add a 70-seat airplane that has 50-plus seats for sale. So it's a tough game, and we have to work as hard as we can locally to get our customers willing to come to the Ithaca Airport. Anecdotally, I had a conversation the other day with a good friend from Dryden, and he said he's got it all figured out. If it's within $100, he's coming to Ithaca. Otherwise, he'll go to Syracuse, but it's not worth the hassle. Well, there 40,000 people last year didn't agree with him and went to Syracuse. And if we could capture them back, we're going to be looking fine. This is our community airport. Remember, most everybody in here is a little bit older. Remember when you were young, you know, airports were fun places to go to? And then after 9/11, it's like prisons. You know, I don't want to go to the airports. You know, they got security there, and I, you know, it's a pain to travel and all that sort of stuff. So we've done a number of things to try to encourage our community, but the airport's part of our community. We're getting out and supporting parades with the fire trucks. That works pretty well. We had a great open house this summer, and people got to run down the runway. It was really fun to watch kids run down the runway with their arms out, you know, like they were taking off. And we'll continue to do that sort of thing. We're very fortunate, too, in that the Thomas More Scout, which has been it's a 1918 airplane. It's been under restoration for a decade, and they lost the place they were using in Dryden. And we got them at the airport, and they're having a big open house on the 4th of October at 1 o'clock. And they're going to start the engine, which is really cool because it's an engine like no engine you've seen before. And the idea is that they're going to finish the restoration, fly the airplane in the centennial year, and then donate it to the airport and the county for display. So we got something really cool going on there because when that airplane was made, Ithaca produced more airplanes than any other community in the world. That's how different things were 100 years ago. And we lost the chance to keep that industry because when they rebid Tommy, a startup Got it. And the startup had access to the material of the day, which was Sitka spruce. And the startup was the Boeing Airplane Company. So if you ever go out to Seattle, you can stop and you can see where Tommy was built after it was built right here in Ithaca. It's kind of like Hollywood, right? The same story. East Hill Flying Club is terrific. They're very diverse in their membership, and they are the biggest flight school in central New York, including Syracuse, Rochester. Just a terrific organization, and they're always having things like pancake breakfasts and discovery flight days. It's a really important thing to be part of this airport community. And lastly, we have a federal response that we're required to meet with the fire trucks. And so we have two, because if we had one, we'd have to shut the airline service down every time one broke, right? And even though they're $750,000 fire trucks, they break. So recently we had one broken, so now we're down to one. And you know what? Lansing loaned us a fire truck, and it's been sitting in our garage for the last couple weeks. Now, why did they do that? They did it because we got off our island and started working with them. And we actually respond in the Cornell Business Park and that stretch of 13 and Warren right there, which is a great place if you're in the response business. A lot of stuff happens at that intersection and around those roads. We're legal and able to respond. And I would hate to have somebody bleed out or die of a heart attack because they were waiting for a company that was located over near Cargill to be able to respond to them. So the reason we're getting help is because we're giving help, and it's working out really well. It's working out really well because, fortunately, we don't have much real action on the airport. And we have the firefighters trained for crash response, but, you know, I'll be plenty happy if they never get involved and, you know, for real. But the one best way you have to train is to respond. You know, we do exercises every few years, but that's not the real thing. And the real thing is what happened on 13 the other day when they had to cut somebody out of a car. And they did it a whole lot faster than the next responders. So we're actively engaged. It's good for us. It's good for our people. It's good for the airport. It's good for Tompkins County. We got a new website coming along. Boy, is that fun. If you've never done a complete overhaul of a website, you know, we've been picking the bones of the beta site all week, and there's some bones to pick. But it'll be released probably within a week. It'll work on your phone and on your computer equally well, which is a huge change. The previous website was a PC kind of a website, and it didn't work that well on the phone. We got a new restaurant. Stop up and have lunch at the Gateway Cafe. They've been going for a few weeks, and we're very pleased so far with their attitude. The quality of the food is excellent. They're beginning to get customers from particularly around the business park. People are coming to the airport. It becomes their airport. Then when they have to travel, they'll be comfortable. They've gone had a sandwich at the Gateway Cafe. Now they'll say, well, I'll book a flight out of Ithaca. New ground transportation. This was a little bit of a struggle. We had an exclusive provider for taxi service before. Now everybody who's licensed in the city of Ithaca is able to provide transportation. I think we've gotten over the tough ground. That's working out really well. There were some bad feelings along the way, but basically we've got more cabs available and there's a little bit more competition for fares while the city and the county work on, you know, the overall issues of taxis and Ubers and Lyfts and stuff. You guys will figure that out. But for right now, it's easier to get to the airport than it was. We also built a nice little TCAT, gave us a little bus house, and the ops guys mounted it. And so now there's a weather shelter for the bus when it comes. A lot of self-help to make us more customer-friendly. And, you know, hopefully when you go there, people say hello and you feel like you're welcome. There's a big emphasis on that, and it's working out well for us. But that alone won't do it. Cost containment and sustainability. We had to work smarter. So we went to new shifts, and we had a reclassification, so that bumped personnel up a little bit, but the new shifts brought us less overtime, a lot more stability in the workforce. We haven't had any instances of people calling in because they didn't want to come to work, which previously was a bit of a problem because we were involved in a shift situation where individuals were more directed when they were going to come to work. Now they get a chance to bid. And people have kind of settled out into patterns, or some people want to work in the evening, or some people want to work in the morning, because we cover almost 20 hours a day. And And so they've been able to sort themselves out nicely. It's working out well. Then we started looking at who's the best provider. And we found our Tompkins County Highway Department. They got one of our fire trucks right now. The alternative is you contract with somebody from Syracuse to come down and work on your fire truck, or you drive the fire truck to Syracuse. That's not a great alternative in some cases. And it turns out that the specialized tools and the specialized knowledge are right here in Tompkins County. So we've been using the highway department to handle our maintenance on a contract exchange basis whenever possible, and it's terrific. I'll tell you something else about them in a minute. And same thing with pavement maintenance. You know, we used to shut the runway down for a couple hours in the morning in the month of June, and guys would go out and they'd crack fill and they'd paint because the runway paint has to be kept up and everything. It was something like $20,000 a year to do this. So it comes to find out, of course, there are companies out there that do this professionally. And we found a company that'll do it, guarantee it for 3 years. And they lay the stripe with GPS, so instead of wandering lines, you know, it's really professional. And they charge a little more than $20,000 a year. So there's real savings, you know, with a warranty and a contractor doing the job. And I mentioned before fleet management. You've seen our vehicles out there. They're kind of this lime green. It's not even in Tompkins County, it doesn't work too well on the auction. So we're switching to white. That's part of the reimbursement. Or reinvestment, excuse me, of some of the savings we've had from this Work Smarter program. And this we learned from the highway department. You can buy a white vehicle off the state list. We're talking about the pickup trucks, not the fire trucks. You buy a white vehicle off the off the state list, drive it for 2 years under warranty, throw it up on auction, and often you even make money on the auction. You turn around and buy another one. Now, that's smart vehicle management. 2 years under warranty, make money. I like that idea. That's a whole lot better than where we were before. And it's just an example, I think, of there's a certain spirit in this county, and we do a lot of crosstalking, and there's some really great ideas out there. You don't have to invent them all. You just have to open your ears. Okay, capital projects. De-icing pad upgrade and expansion. Last year we had a release of de-icing fluid. We had no speedies permit violation associated with that, but it's totally unacceptable for anybody off the airport to go out in their backyard and smell de-icing fluid. So we changed our management practice and had no further incidents last winter. And furthermore, this summer we've doubled the size of the catch basin and redone all the plumbing and tanks and what have you as part of a project, which really was to double the size of the pad. But I can tell you with pretty good assurance, we don't expect to upset our neighbors anymore in this regard. And I'm going to ask each one of them that I've heard from to make sure that they keep their eyes open, keep an eye on us, and make sure that we are doing what we said we were going to do. It's not the worst release, but it smells bad, and it's not acceptable. We got a new roof coming on we got a grant to replace the roof on the crash fire rescue building. Solar City has a big array going in across the runway from the terminal side, and we're excited about that. There's a rental fee associated with it. It's involved in some kind of push around with the city of Ithaca, but it's a good place to put the panels because they're protected. And in this case, it's the part of the airport that is not developable for business for business office buildings, things like that. So it's a good spot for it, and we're happy to be a part of that. Next summer, we're going to overlay the runway. Hasn't been done for a decade or more, and we're excited about that project. It means the airport will be closed for a week, but it's the only way you can do it with one runway. Yeah, we got a new fire truck coming. That also is a federal grant with a little bit of county contribution. The terminal security upgrade is a huge project because it fixes a lot of things that need attention, HVAC systems, roofing, all that sort of stuff in the terminal, along with upgrading the security. And I'll talk to you more about that in time to come. We're going to need some economic development money and other grant sources because it's too big a project to fund with bonding alone. And then the last two are relatively new ideas. One is to relocate the fuel farm. Now, if you're familiar with the airport and East Hill Flying Club, right behind East Hill Flying Club toward the runway is where all the fuel on the airport is. That is not a good place for the fuel. And a good place for the fuel is down just off Warren Road behind the Sheriff's Department, where you've got better access for the tank trucks and you're not storing all the fuel in the middle of a congested area with airplanes, vehicles, et cetera. So that's just an early concept. It was adopted as part of the strategic plan, and we'll be putting the details together and sharing those with you. And lastly, the Flying Club is in a building that is way, way old, and if we relocated them a little bit deeper in the ramp and relocated the fuel farm, we'd have some commercially developable property with both airside and groundside access right there at the heart of the airport. And that would be a big plus in terms of getting rents to support airport operations in the years to come. And you could think about customers like UPS and FedEx. I don't know that it would necessarily be either of them, but somebody that's looking for both airside access and groundside access. So that's where we are, subject to any questions that you may have about the budget.
Questions for Mike?
Yes.
Anyone? Martha?
I'm glad to hear that the employments are at least leveling off. Do you think is that true in the other regional airports?
Do I think it's...
Do you have any sense, any data on, you know, Syracuse, Binghamton? Are they on the same kind of trajectory as we are?
Everybody with regard, I didn't quite hear that well, but with regard to the three main carriers, United, American, and Delta, each of our southern tier airports is down in an equivalent number. What's made Elmira stronger is they got Allegiant to come in there and fly, and Allegiant takes a lot of leisure people out of there. So their numbers are up compared to where they were. But if you track the big three, we come down together. Going back to the subject of economics, really the reason we declined is the airlines decided to consolidate, and they decided that you could drive 2 miles, 2 hours, and they decided to consolidate, and they just took the seats away. And if we got two more flights a day to Detroit or to some reliable hub, we'd be right back at our all-time high. So part of the decline is, well, I would say the lion's share of any decline we've had is directly related to airline policy. Now, the federal government is starting to get interested in this, and they're thinking maybe when they granted merger authority from 6 to become 3, they took competition, you know, too far off the table. But that's not going to be a quick fix. But right now, frankly, if they put more flights on, we'd fill them. But it might hurt their operation at other airports. So they like to look at, in my opinion, they like to look at Central New York as a big airport. Syracuse, Binghamton, Elmira, and Ithaca. That's all within 2 hours, even Rochester. And all they want is that regional pool to give them revenue maximization on the few airplanes that they have. I'm most excited about Delta right now because they are actively looking at buying their feeder fleets and bringing them into the mainline, which would then make them like JetBlue and Southwest. You know, they're actually our airplanes, not yours, that we're renting. And I think that ownership would help. The other thing is Delta is working extremely hard on customer service. And it shows. If you fly with them, they have now reached in the ratings game. They're right up there with Southwest, which is pretty rarefied air. And we have an extremely reliable airport in Ithaca. The guys are doing a terrific job keeping it open in spite of one of the worst winters last year. We were closed for a couple hours for things that we could, like snow removal. We're extremely reliable. Detroit is reliable, much as Pittsburgh is reliable. So if you want to see the past revisited, Delta from Ithaca to Detroit is much like U.S. Airways from Ithaca to Pittsburgh in the old days. That flight runs in the 90s and above in terms of reliability. American is next. They run in the mid-80s, and United is down around 80. And those two reliability numbers are driven by a number of factors. The one that we don't have much control over is Northeast airspace hubs. So they, you know, even if they did things perfectly, it'd be hard for them to get above 90. But they also need to be pressured to do a better job than they're doing.
Any other questions for Michael? Mike Lane.
Mike, I know you were looking into trying to get more information from the airlines about why flights were canceled, mechanical or lack of sales or whatever. Are you getting that information at any more reliable rate now?
We've improved some. We've given them a lot of feedback, but a lot of it's the airline. Delta was delayed this morning, and they bought everybody breakfast in the cafe. United is notorious for selling seats on a 50-seat airplane and then substituting a 35-seat airplane and telling you good luck, you know. So there's a big difference in terms of customer focus between the airlines. And, of course, United has got other major problems at the top. They're minus a president and CEO over some scandal down in the Newark area. And so most of our pressure and most of what we've gotten some improvement with is American and United, but they've got a long ways to go, And when we complained bitterly last year, they came back and they said, well, we've added a desk manager to watch the flights during the day. And, you know, they had a little more supervision so they could pick out when a flight was starting to go bad and maybe come up with some alternatives. But they've got a ways to go. And I'm not saying anything that any community around here wouldn't say with regard to the reliability of the airlines. It's all published, you know, on a monthly basis. We just unfortunately live it personally here in Ithaca. But there's no, you know, we don't command the ability. This is an interesting business. They offer you a product on their terms. They set no standards with regard to reliability of the service. They're pretty far out. There's some competition, you know, needs to happen here. Unfortunately, there's so much capital involved in the airline business, it's going to be tough for somebody to start an airline. But I think you mentioned the other day, one of these days somebody's going to, you know, say, hey, we've got a Northern Airlines or an Empire Airlines or something, and we're going to start doing things that the big guys won't do. But, again, here we are in 2016 budget, and it's not going to happen in 2016. So we got to work with them, keep the pressure on them, and hope that they can improve the quality of their operation.
Martha.
I know we're going long, but see if we can do this quickly. My question is about, we heard a news story a couple of months ago about a possible change in regulations at LaGuardia.
Yep.
That was going to affect, actually not us because we don't go to LaGuardia, but it would potentially long-term affect us and certainly other immediately to other upstate airports. Can you briefly explain that and tell us where it stands?
LaGuardia is slot controlled, which means that to fly into LaGuardia, you need to have a reservation. And those reservations are standing reservations. That's what a slot is because, after all, I want to fly there every day at 10 o'clock, so I have a standing slot. Over time, with various trades, service to Washington Reagan versus LaGuardia, et cetera, those slots were redistributed. And that's when we lost LaGuardia service because U.S. Airways at the time traded the LaGuardia slots for Reagan National. Changing or upgrading LaGuardia isn't going to change its capacity significantly. It's just going to make it a nicer experience when you get there. LaGuardia, like everybody else in New York, wants that 400-seat airplane from Los Angeles, not the 40-seat airplane from Ithaca. So getting slots in New York is tough. What I suggested relative to the 1,500-mile rule, because that's what they want to relax. They want to be able to have flights from LaGuardia to California, not just LaGuardia to Omaha, was that in exchange for relaxing that distance restriction, the airlines be required to serve upstate New York. because Metropolitan New York is our economic engine and Tompkins County is our economic engine. And the rest of upstate New York, I think right now, is limited in its ability to develop economically because of this shaky air service situation. We're a little bit too close to New York, not quite close enough for surface transportation, although the buses are, you know, showing up, but a little bit too close, you know, to fly big airplanes. So I wouldn't care about the 1,500-mile rule, but I would negotiate relaxing that in exchange for a guarantee of service to Syracuse, Rochester, Ithaca, Binghamton, Elmira, you know, we'll see.
Anyone else? Peter?
I'm sorry, I got here a little late and I didn't hear the beginning of your talks, but something perked up my ears when you talked about the airline belief that people will drive 2 hours to an airport. And I just wondered in my head, what airport does that open up? If you believe that, what airport does that open up for us?
Rochester.
Rochester, okay.
Yeah, it's an hour to Syracuse. Now, these
Syracuse has been that way for a long time. That's nothing new.
These numbers are numbers that we glean from articles in trade publications, Wall Street Journal, what have you. But when you read those articles and you say, you know, the airlines really are happy enough if you're within 2 hours of a destination they serve, and then you look at what's happening, it kind of makes sense. So I think there is a pattern there. And they will load level to some degree across the airports. If they have multiple airports within that two-hour ring, they'll load level with fares to some degree, I believe. And that's just the climate we're in. So we have to figure out how to make our airport so important to them as a market that they'll serve us here, because if we leave here and go to those other airports, we may not get on their airplane. That's the flip side of this is you want to capture them and take them all the way to Shanghai, capture them right here in Tompkins County, and they're yours all the way to Shanghai. You want me to drive to Syracuse? Oh, well, I'll take a look at whatever. Or I'll take the bus to New York City and get on Eastern China. You know, it's just you want to capture them, get them here in Tompkins County. That's our pitch.
Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate your description and input here. Up next is the Office of Human Rights. It will be on Section 4, page 226. They have 1 OTR, number 47.
What page in Section 4?
226.
It's alphabetized by office, not human rights. Thank you.
All right.
Which button do I do? Sit down.
Good evening, honorable legislators. I'd like to present to you the 2016 budget for the Office of Human Rights. And I'm a Mac person, so please, my instructions are down. Okay. So there you see an overview of our 2016 budget, the 2015, the 2016 recommended. It looks like there's a decrease of 3.25%, but I believe that has to do with the fluctuation of the impact of the fringe rate. So we're not too worried about that. This budget does represent, and at least since I have been here, we're talking about mainly personnel expenses. Discretionary spending in my budget has generally been between $17,000 and $20,000, and that would be programming, training, supplies, and memberships. So, in general, that's what we look at. We look at that pot of money to be able to do what we want to do each year to make sure that we're having both an educational and an enforcement impact on the community. And that represents about 6-7% of our budget. We have four slots, full-time employee slots. Our office did go through somewhat of a transition this year. I want to talk a little bit about that and also be able to say the names of my staff. It's very small. There are four of us. Carmen Arroyo is our receptionist. She is the first person that people see or speak to on the phone. She's bilingual, and she sits at the front of our office, and she does initial intakes for people, for walk-ins, and for people who call. She is our longest-term employee. She's been there 11 years. And we also have a full-time a program and outreach specialist. That transition in that position with Sarah Simmons, she has been reduced to part-time. And she has, well, actually, she's had a transition in her career, but she was willing to work part-time until we refill the position with a full-time replacement. And our intention is to do that some point in 2016. So until that point, Sarah Simmons will be doing our outreach, will be our outreach specialist. She has been there almost 2 years now. Our other transition is with our paralegal aid position. James Douglas, who was here when I arrived, was our paralegal aid. He told me early on this year that he would be transitioning to Washington, D.C., and so while he was looking for a job, we prepared for his departure. I just want to say, especially if this is televised, he got this fantastic job working in the council office of HUD headquarters in D.C. As a paralegal. So we're very proud of him, and we wish him a lot of luck. We've made an offer on that position to our new staff member. We expect to be on board early October. His name is Xavier Rusk. He comes to us from Legal Assistance of Western New York and has paralegal experience, and we're really very much looking forward to his arrival and becoming the most diverse department of the county. This is kind of our mission. This is how we frame the things we do at the Office of Human Rights. This is kind of our template for how we gauge our programming needs and enforcement needs. We try in any given day, any given week, or especially in any given fiscal year, to pay attention to all of these types of initiatives. We see our work as contributing to healing processes, celebrating diversity, and encouraging dialogue throughout the county. Our mantra is that we balance our activities between enforcement and education. So, and my staff my staff is kind of coordinated for that purpose, having a paralegal and an outreach specialist, so that we can balance both enforcement efforts and outreach and education. And our goal is to make those impacts countywide. And of course, we rely on the legislature to provide us some sustainability and being able to continue to do this work and to have an impact. And we think that Tompkins County is a great place to do this work and that it's highly valued. Some of our activities or goals for 2016, I have about six of them here. I'm sure we'll be doing lots of other things. In terms of enforcement, Our goal is to enhance the local civil rights protections and to strengthen anti-discrimination enforcement throughout the county. I told you last year when I was here that by July 1st of 2015, that my intention was to have a draft, a redraft of the local anti-discrimination law. And I'm glad to say that on June 30th of this year, I provided that to Joe. And I'm looking forward to spending some part of 2016 having a community discussion about the draft, getting input, hearing other people's visions, reactions to the draft, because I think it's very important that the community buys in. First of all, that the community knows what our local law currently looks like and how we might want to change that, how we might want to make it more inclusive, and how we might want to create more protections in terms of enforcement mechanisms. So I'm looking forward to that conversation, not only with administrators, but also legislators, but the community at large. In terms of education and outreach, our focus, I mentioned three of our annual programs. This year, we, in fact, it's already underway, our 28th annual K-12 arts competition and awards ceremony is already in all of the schools, K-12, throughout Tompkins County. We had the privilege of doing some summer training with social studies teachers through the BOCES program to give them tools for how to incorporate the 30 articles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in their teaching plans. I'm not sure if you're aware, but the 30 articles is now the theme of the arts competition. Previously, it was Martin Luther King and his legacy. But the theme now are the 30 articles of the Declaration. It also represents a part of the Common Core, which recommends that these articles be somehow integrated in social studies and other types of classes in K-12. So we see it as adding value to the work that teachers are already doing or being asked to do, and also providing teachers and students an opportunity to have these discussions in their classroom about human rights at a very general and basic level. So we're rolling out the program now. It used to be in the spring term. It's now in the fall term. So next year will be our 29th annual. We also annually do the Human Rights Day for Kids program, which is Southside and GIAC Kids. It's an after-school program. Generally takes place on December 10th, which is International Human Rights Day. And we have a special program. It's mainly geared for grades 2 through 5. It's interactive, and we've done it 2 years so far here in Tompkins County, and the kids seem to really enjoy it and learn a lot about the basic human rights protections. We continue also for the second year, What Would MLK Say Today poster contest, which is open to people of all ages in Tompkins County. And this year we are trying to negotiate a partnership with the Workers Resource Center and making the theme, What Would MLK Say Today About Livable Wage? So we're looking forward to having a community discussion about possibly what MLK might have thought about a living wage. I think part of his legacy is very clear what he thought about it, and so it will be a great opportunity to engage people on that topic. The office is also involved in assisting the county in its state and federal mandated civil rights certifications. I list them here for you. Limited English Proficiency Plan, which is required by Title VI. the ADA in Section 504, the county's obligation to affirmatively further fair housing, which is required by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and minority and women-owned business enterprises. And our office has been in the process of assisting the county in developing these types of plans and compliance issues, and we look forward to assisting in the future. We are looking forward to working with the Human Rights Commission. They are posed to reintegrate themselves, and to they're very eager to be more active and to create a strategy for going forward. And the protocols for the office and how the commission works together, very positive. We support their work and they support our efforts. And so we think that's really important going forward, and we look forward to that collaboration. Again, the office is continually interested in trying to build and establish relationships with state and federal enforcement agencies for the purpose of attracting resources from those agencies to do local enforcement activities. And the local law, the redraft of the local law, is key to developing that relationship. Many of these state and federal agencies are interested in communities that have local laws that look like their laws. And so in many ways, the local law, seeing that it looks like the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, and other federal and state laws, will help us perhaps create collaborative arrangements with outside agencies. And six, the office, as a rule, doesn't really do programming without some type of collaboration. We think it's really important that even if it's a program that we've developed and that we provide a lot of the resources for, or in terms of human resources, that we reach out to other agencies and organizations in order to roll out the types of programming that we'd like to see be done in Tompkins County. I have to say that the arts competition this year is being co-sponsored with the Dorothy Cotton Institute. And that organization has been heavily involved in teaching teachers through the framework of the 30 articles of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, how to incorporate that into their classrooms. And so it's been a really great partnership in terms of, you know, a real foundation for the change in the program, as well as getting kids and teachers talking about, or how to talk about, these issues. And so we very much appreciate that collaboration. We also collaborated, we'll be collaborating with the Tompkins Seneca Tioga BOCES, to continue those efforts and finding creative ways for teachers to explore basic human rights issues in their classroom. And also, our intention is to collaborate with the Avon Global Center for Women and Justice. If you recall, they were the institution that was behind the freedom of domestic violence as a human right effort that was made over the last few months, in which this legislature passed a resolution, the city passed a resolution in support, and I believe every other municipality within Tompkins County garnered support for such a resolution. So they've asked the Office of Human Rights to partner with them and find strategies for going forward for how to make those types of initiatives meaningful and not just resolutions. So we'll be working with them. And as a rule, we work closely with GIAC and the Southside Community Centers in our Human Rights Day programming. And our intention is to explore further partnerships with those agencies. In terms of the budget, I think this is Joe's slide. our situation was that last year we asked for an OTR to do training, professional training for me and for my staff, for networking purposes, national conferences and such. As it turned out, we were pretty busy this year, and none of my staff were able to take the time off to attend any conferences. So the money that was targeted for that purpose is still there. And I guess we were just requesting that we could, especially in the coming year, in which I will be having two new staff members. I'll be having a new paralegal aide and a new outreach specialist. It will be very important that they receive the training that's necessary. My goal is to my goal is to have staffing that has longevity. And in order to do that, I want to make sure that they see rewards and they see professional advancement in their positions. And so I think especially this year, that amount of money is in particularly important to our staff development.
Just make a quick technical correction. I think the request was for one-time money. I think the 87, and that's our mistake because we help with the slides. So I think it was a request for $8,750 in one-time money, and then the recommendation is for $2,900, but in target funding for travel and training.
Right, and I wouldn't be opposed necessarily for target money. I understand the logic of that. So if any of you have any questions?
Questions. Dooley, go ahead.
If I understood what you said toward the end, that you asked for and received $8,750 last year, but for various reasons you weren't able to make use of it. Does that mean you still have that money?
Yeah, it's in my budget now, yes. It would roll over, I would guess.
Yeah, wondering if you've asked for rollover.
That would be 2015 rollover funds, which technically don't exist yet, right, really?
Okay. And the $8,750 represented like a fivefold increase for what had been done in a previous year. So if you have a fair amount left and this $2,900 is roughly two times what used to be part of the budget, I guess being conservative, that seems generous to me. So I don't have any problem with the way it's turning out. The trainings, I don't know what that you had planned. I remember talking with you briefly about attending conferences and networking. That seemed to be the main focus. Now you're mm-hmm. talking about training in a different way. So you didn't distinguish between those a year ago.
Yeah. Mainly because, in my mind, I've been to these conferences where networking takes place, and there's invariably training opportunities. So I've never taken advantage of a conference for the purpose of networking that didn't also provide opportunities for training agenda.
You aren't talking about separate training.
Right.
Okay. I guess I understand. Thanks.
Peter.
The two OTRs, what I heard sounded like the administrator has supported both of those. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know what the logistics is. Are you talking about the one of last year?
No, I'm just looking what's up there, okay?
Well, we requested $8,750.
Right.
And Joe is recommending the $2,900 as a target instead of an OTR. Not in addition, right? But instead of one time.
So I thought you had that $8,750 because you got it in rollover.
It hasn't rolled over yet. Is that the technical explanation?
So there's 87.
Joe, could you explain to us?
I'll try.
Yeah.
So in the 2015 budget, you approved $8,750 in one-time money for her budget for travel and training. Because the staff hasn't been able to travel this year, it's very likely that money will go unspent. So it won't happen this year. So what Karen has asked for is basically a repeat in 2016. She's asked again for an OTR for $8,750. The request was one-time money for travel and training. So she only asked for one OTR. It was this one. And I did not approve the $8,750 in one time, but I did approve $2,900 in ongoing money for travel and training.
Right. I understand that. But what I thought I heard Karen say in response to Dooley's question is that she didn't spend the $8,750 that she had, so it would be rolled over.
In 2015. But there is no rollover until the year ends because rollover only exists when your bottom line balances. So there is no certified rollover at all. You can't assume that because $8,750 wasn't spent in one account, that by the end of the year there'll be $8,750 left over in the entire budget.
You didn't spend it, but didn't spend...
If the rest of the budget finished to the penny and you didn't spend the $8,750 in this account, then you're right. You'd have a rollover to bring into the following year.
So is that what's being done or no?
Because
the year isn't over yet.
So what will happen is if Karen doesn't spend the $8,750 this year and everything else finishes the penny, that money will just fall into fund balance.
But the year isn't over yet. Right. Okay. Thank you.
Martha, you had a question?
Why would it fall into fund balance?
Nothing. It's unspent. So if nothing happens to it, if it's not spent, the default is that it would fall into fund balance. That's too generic. That would be available for her rollover for the following year if the rest of the budget balanced.
Right, that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that target money, that $8,750?
No, that was one-time money also.
Last
year.
Or 2015.
This year.
Okay.
Yep.
Karen, in the past we've gotten, whether it's annual reports or just different, you know, formats of kind of reports of your caseloads, of what, how many cases walk in the door, what kinds of issues, and I wonder if you've got that compiled and if we could get a hold of it.
Yeah, we keep those records on a regular basis. And in terms of drafting a formal report, I'm not quite sure what the protocol was in the past or how that works. It's something that I provide to Joe as my boss, and then he provides it to the legislature, or how that works, I'm not sure.
Well, I'm just asking for the expanded budget committee to get a compilation. You don't have to do anything fancy, just of this year's cases, what types of cases, and, you know, compare it to a few years back, if that's possible.
Absolutely, I can do that.
Thank you.
Karen, I have a question. I heard you mention a bit ago about two employees. You're losing two employees. Right now you have four employees. You're losing two, and you're going to replace them, or were you talking about two new employees?
Well, they're existing positions that are being, one has transitioned out, and there'll be a new staff person coming in. And the other is remaining part-time until we go through the process. We haven't had time yet to canvass that position. My intention is to wait until next year to fill that position with the part-time status.
So you perceive your budget, if it's approved as is, you would have four positions for 2016.
Yes.
Anyone else have a question? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sheriff's Office, Section 4, page 260, and I think all of goes to 268, and some OTRs 54 through 62.
We have people coming back, Jim.
We're all set. You're on.
Okay. Thank you.
Go to it. Welcome.
Okay. This gives you the overall budget for the Civil and Road Division, some of the projected numbers and revenues.
Can you go back a little bit?
I can. Any questions on that?
No, we'll do the questions.
Okay. Okay.
Thanks.
Effects that have created a difference. One of the biggest things that has become an issue is replacement of equipment, especially our office equipment. The last 4 years, our budgets, we've kept them at, as requested, to zeros and even a minus 1%. It's finally caught up to us, and there are things that just can't continue to be used without us trying to get them updated and replaced. So that is one of the things that you'll see in this request tonight in the civil department. One of them is definitely the cabinets. It takes a special skill to open and close our drawers at this point in time on our cabinets, as crazy as that sounds. Road budget influences the general wear on the equipment and, of course, overtime has been a question. A need for fleet maintenance and replacement. We have not been able to keep up with what usually is the general need for our fleet, and that's usually a replacement of as many as 5 cars a year. I think we've been at 3. We now, that is starting to catch up to us in our maintenance costs to keep these cars on the road. Overtime and premium pay expenses, that'll be addressed in this presentation. The premium pay, how it's been calculated and given out has been an issue, and we're working on that with finance to correct that. We have not changed in the numbers at all in our divisions. They still staying constant. We're not requesting any more personnel as much as we'd like to. We know we can't. Our over-target request that we are asking to be supported here, we obviously are, again, looking for some one-time expenses, one-time expense funding for two new CID vehicles. What I'd like to remind is about 2 years into my first term, we took and got rid of a lot of the CID, that's the criminal investigators' cars. They were using them as take-home cars. We took that and away from them and brought the cars back to the office and stay there. But then I also took and got rid of most of those vehicles. They were Impalas. And thanks to Frank Cooper, we made a deal with him to take some of his smaller Malibu four-cylinders and one of his Focuses. To replace the cars for the CID people to use during the day while they were working. Those vehicles have been used ever since and really need to be replaced now because they really weren't meant for what we did, but we were trying to keep the budget expenses down. So we'll be replacing those vehicles because they need to go. Purchase of some desktop scanners for our civil office. We feel that that'll help us keep the paper trail down and the filing cabinets. We won't need as many. We would like each one of the ladies at their desk to have one to make it convenient. So that's why we're requesting them. And then, like I said, the filing cabinets are in a huge need to be replaced because the girls are having a difficult time even using them, and it really is an issue of how they open them and close them. So, again, another target request for patrol vehicles for the road. One of the things that you have to understand that has happened now with these vehicles, our 911 system and our computer system that we use, those radios and the computers are at the end of their usefulness and need to be updated and replaced. So when you think about replacing a car, it's not only just the cost of the vehicle, it now is the cost of replacing the equipment that is inside of those vehicles. They need to be replaced because the other ones are failing or have already failed and had to be replaced. So now we include in the price of the vehicles replacing these items also. So it's not just the car itself. Another thing that we are requesting is a routine equipment needs. One of the items that has become an issue, and that is our tasers. As all companies tend to do, they phase out their old models and also the parts to fix them, so we no longer can replace the parts that are needed in our old tasers, so new tasers are needed, the new styles. So we're slowly replacing them, and we're asking for some extra money to do that. It's a very useful part of our equipment and our officers' daily patrol. Over target request not supported by this. We are looking at an adjustment in the overtime budget. I can say that looking at our budget in the past and our lines in the past, our line on the overtime is still looks as it has in the past, but now because of how we're doing our presentation of the line, it shows right now that we are going to be short. In years past, when the budget line showed almost what they are showing now, at the end of the year, it seemed that we were able to cover that. So that's just a point that sticks out to us. Is that going to happen this year? I would hope so, but I can't positively say that at this point in time. So we're requesting this $193,000. Recommended budget for corrections and medical board outs. There's an increase here, obviously. We have had many issues with the numbers of people that we've had in our corrections facility. The numbers have not gone down. Obviously, our extra seven beds are only in the stages of being built. Unfortunately, they weren't done like we had hoped that, earlier this year, but that was nobody's fault. The medical aspect, I can tell you that has become a real issue for our corrections. It appears we surely have had our share of some difficult patients, I will say, in our in our inmate population. I know that recently we had one inmate that had to have a pill that cost us $1,200 or $1,300 a day. Okay. We have also had several of our inmates have to spend time at CMC. So that obviously raised our overtime expenses also. We also have had some inmates that come in with need to have IVs administered to them in a timely fashion. So There's a lot of concerns, and that's what's raised our cost in the medical field. We really could even use some more help as far as our nurses are concerned, because some of these things that need to be administered need to be administered after she leaves during the day. So effects on the budget that have created the difference, obviously the age of our facility and our equipment that we have there also that needs to be replaced. And you know, with new equipment and updates. So I can say that, you know, so that we don't are not just looking to the taxpayers and this committee to approve some of the things. Some of the monies that we have gotten to replace other items that we, thank goodness, did not have to ask you for would be our live scan facility. That's the, what we use when we bring prisoners in on both sides of the facility, on the road and on the jail. This is the machine that processes and helps us process all the fingerprints and photographs necessary to book and arraign and arrest people. We have one on each side of our facility, but we're happy to say it appears that we have gotten grant money to replace those very expensive items. Recently, one was not working as well on the roadside, so Captain Bunce was gracious enough to let us move his live scan to our side, so since we tend to use it a little bit more than they do, and he took ours, it works on and off. But they hope to be replaced here shortly. Increased inmate housing, continued board outs. Obviously, as we said, you know, our seven beds aren't done. But with that being said, there are times and issues that take and don't allow us to use all the beds. And recently, one of our biggest concerns is that our corrections facility has become a institution for those who have possible mental illness, people that have problems with addiction. And most recently, we'd had a inmate in there that really needed to be in a home, had dementia and a walker. So with that being said, there are times when we have to make room for these people, and they can't be in with the general population. So you may have some of our beds completely empty because we can only put one of these people because of their special needs in the facility, in that part of the facility. So I want people to understand that. Another thing I'd like to bring up at this point in time also is with the overtime. I know that's a concern. It's a concern of ours. We work very diligently at trying to make sure that we control that to the best of our ability. And some of the things I want people to understand that we do and what our officers do on both sides. Ray does a great job. As you know, we've had some projects up there with the cell towers, and now we have obviously the project going on with our addition. That means that an officer has to be out there at all times making sure the workers are doing what they're supposed to do as far as coming and leaving the facilities, obviously not building the project. Ray has been able, and we've been able to use people that are on a 207C that have gotten a waiver to be able to come back to the facility and do what we call light duty, because it only entails them being out there watching and not being involved with the inmates. We also have had the ability, when we do have a few people on extra, they do some of the transports rather than calling somebody in for overtime. We also do similar things on the road. We have officers that are willing to change their shift for us and for the department and actually work in overtime without being in overtime and it being in lieu of taking another day off. So I just want you to know that I know these are concerns of yours, they're concerns of ours, the cost of the overtime that you see here, but we are working diligently to make sure that we do our best to not create overtime. And it's obviously need-driven and not something that we do just because we think we want to do it. So corrections full-time equivalents, you see that, again, there's no request for any extra at this point in time. I wish we could because our facility really could use some extra help in there. All right. Our over-target requests, partly supported by this recommended budget, you can see here, adjustment again, we've asked for in the jail overtime budget. Adjustment for board out cost. And also, again, for funding for ongoing needs. Some of the things, again, inside the correction facility, the radios, they also use radios there to keep in touch with each one of the posts inside the corrections facility. Computers are at the stations that are manned by the corrections officers that could need replacement. And so that's why we're requesting this at this time.
Questions. Ken, I want to start. I'm stunned by something I just heard, that a judge put someone in jail who has dementia. Did you say that, or did I mishear that?
Oh, you did not.
And who would have possibly done that?
I'd rather not say it now. If you want to talk to me later, I'd be glad to.
Is that not public record?
Well, you know, I'm not here. I'm here to present my budget, Jim, and not to,
Well, you just used that as a cost factor, and I understand that. I would certainly talk to you later,
sure.
But is a sentencing like that not public record, or that's not done behind closed doors?
Who's sentenced, but maybe not some of the issues with their health would not be. That's obviously.
Okay. HIPAA, all right. So. I'll let it go.
Okay.
I mean, it's stunning. That's all.
Well,
who else wants to ask a question? Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, this is not what I put my hand up for, but it just occurred to me that, you know, people may have different ideas of their own as to what's dementia. It's not like a broken
Well, yeah, I'm on the county legislature. I get that.
Right. Okay, good. Anyway, my questions, I had two questions. One is premium pay. I have no idea what that is. I don't remember ever having heard it before.
No.
So I wonder if you could explain that to me, and then I have another question after that.
Premium pay generally is when holiday pay or on-call pay gets pulled out of that line. In the past, it's been being pulled out of other payroll out of other personnel lines, not necessarily that one. So I believe it's just a new payroll program. It's just how it's been pulling. The funds have always been in the budget, but it has been pulling from the premium pay line.
Okay, I don't understand, but I'll find out later. The other thing,
Joe might be able to clarify a little better.
I think Ashley's got the gist of it. The money has always been spent. It's where it's accounted for within the budget. And this year, it seems that finance is accounting for certain types of expenditures in the premium line that they didn't before. I think there too, and Ken talked about something that we're looking at right now as well, which is the way overtime is paid for a certain duty. It's basically when somebody is called in on their day off, what the appropriate rate should be. So there's an internal discussion here about what's the Fair Labor Standards Act required us to pay and so forth. So when Ken talks about how we're looking at one item of premium pay with the goal of trying to reduce that amount, that's what he was referring to. So again, the money has always been in this budget. It probably showed up in the large overtime account instead of a premium pay account. So you didn't see it. So that's the accounting change. The effort to control that cost is what I just talked about, which is the review of what the law requires us to pay for fellows or people who come in on their day off, their regular day off, and work overtime.
Okay, so what I understand you to say is it's sort of the same thing as overtime, but it doesn't fit into the Fair Labor Act that defines what overtime is. It's not right.
At the risk of I think that gets close. Premium pay, when you look at premium pay in most budgets, it's what Ashley said. So it's on-call time. People get a premium for that. It's shift differential. They get paid a little more when they work the night shift.
Okay.
It's longevity. It's some other things like that. You put it into this premium account, and it looks, I think, beginning this year, some of what has traditionally been counted as overtime is showing up in the premium pay line.
Okay. The other question I had was I heard you say, maybe I didn't hear it right, but that when we're getting some new cars, we have to replace the electronics that goes with them. And that surprised me a little bit because our whole electronics is only like 5 years old, right? I mean, that
some of them, I believe it's probably correct.
When the new system came into effect, I know it was when I was here, and I've only been here 5 years, so mm-hmm. Sounds to me like it was like 4 years old, and I wondered why it had to be replaced.
They are, the IT was a suggestion, they are failing, Peter. They're replacing the keyboards and things. The radios are being updated. Lee, I'm sure, has explained that in other presentations, and it's something that we just don't control, and it's not like we just want new equipment because it's nicer looking and more functional. It's just the other equipment is failing, and the computers and things. For the Spillman system and what we use in the cars. So
do we have to really think that with the Spillmans that we have to replace every three?
No, what'll happen, Peter, as we buy, let's say we buy five cars this year and they're all replaced. Now that will be continued to be changed over. A car usually lasts about 3 years, okay? So in the past, yes, we just changed all the equipment over. The radios, the lights, the computers, everything is changed over when all that is in working condition. Now what has been recommended is and needed is that not every one of those cars, but the ones that are being replaced where the equipment is faulty or ready to, they want us to put brand new in and replace it that way is how a lot of it's being done.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Will, then Martha.
Back on overtime, Joe, you did not recommend the OTR relative to the overtime, and I know it's been an issue in our current budget. Can you sort of explain your thinking?
Yeah, and I looked at both Road Patrol and jail, so we can talk about both. What I tried to do is to look backward to see what kind of overtime levels we'd seen over the past 5 years. And in looking at that, because you always try to budget for the normal, not the abnormal, the aberrant. So, and that's what I've tried to do here. So on Road Patrol, I look back and I saw that this year we've got kind of a spike. We've got a high level of overtime this year, perhaps for unique circumstances this year. And when I looked at what the average tends to be over time, it looks to me like the budgeted level is attainable without additional money being put into that account on the Road Patrol side through this OTR. I think if it's a vigilant approach, I think it's an attainable number. On the jail side, it's a different story. So I look back through history, and what I found was they need more money. So historically, we've gone over the budget. And what Ken was saying earlier is often in those years, there might have been surpluses in other accounts. So it could be that overtime was incurred because vacancy rates were high, so you save some money there, you apply it to overtime to cover. And maybe by the end of the year, much of that overtime excess had been covered elsewhere. But I'm not sure that that's the way you ought to budget things. I think you ought to budget based on what you actually expect to spend. And as hard as I tried to bring that number down, in my judgment, they need another $140,000 on the jail side to have a budget that still they're going to have to work to achieve it, but to give them a budget that is achievable.
Thank you.
Martha and then Mike Lane.
So that was one of my questions. And then on the cars, Joe, so how many, and right. Maybe you said this, Ken, but the request was for six vehicles.
Yeah, I think there's
five vehicles. How many are we getting instead? If this OTR is what's funded?
I think it'll be in the range of 4 to 5, depending on how much extra stuff. So in the base budget, there's 60. If we're talking about Road Patrol,
right?
In Road Patrol, I don't have it in front of me. I think the base budget had $64,000 was in the target budget. That's it. That's all there was to purchase vehicles in the Road Patrol side. Mm-hmm. So my recommendation is to add another 120 mm-hmm. for patrol cars. So when you add those two things together, the 180, 84. I think will buy between 4 and 5
right. It was between 4 and 5, and then we'd asked for two criminal investigator cars in the other over target line.
Right, which we gave. So those, since they so rarely buy the regular sedans, the CID cars, that those were paid for with one-time money. So there's another two there.
So what's missing is about is $88,000 in OTR number 55. So that's, say, two cars shy of what you'd like. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
How many cars?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mike. I actually got three things. One, just following up on that, what will we do if we buy 4 or 5 cars this year in 3 years? If we've only got $79,000 in the budget? I mean, where would the replacement money be?
I probably mumbled through here. The extra money that we would put in through the OTR, $120,000 will be target.
It's target.
Target,
okay.
Right.
So they'll have a target budget of 180. And to us, that was important to us to be have recurring, a reasonable amount of recurring money to buy a reasonable number of cars every year. That was the goal.
And the other ones go to auction, and of course we try to, you know, supplement what little we get with that. But
second, we're hoping to have the jail construction done, what, at the end of the year?
Yeah, I think, was it November? December 14th, okay.
Do you see the addition of the 7 beds there having an effect on this overtime and the board out costs that we've got? Is that going to help bring those down?
That surely was the intent, and we're still hoping that will be, you know, what happens. There's no doubt about it. Right now, I mean, it just seems to be one moment we'll turn around and where you got 5 or 6 board outs, you could literally come back on Monday and we got 15. I've had the corrections people say many a time, well, we just got rid of 5 people to the state, but 6 more came in from various agencies or parole, you know, the violation. So it's been crazy that way. But yes, that is the intent. That is our hopes that it will do that. That's exactly what the whole idea about that project was, you know, to help us with the board outs.
The last thing I wanted to ask about, and that is that our sister county of Cortland is having trouble with its jail over there. They're having a lot of board outs. They've had to put in a big dormitory, mm-hmm. and they're concerned about it. At one time, we actually had a committee discussing with Cortland whether a joint jail might be an option. Have you had any kind of discussions about this with your counterpart in Cortland at all?
The sheriff, I met with him, I think it was last year, and his undersheriff for other issues, and it was discussed. And again, the issue there is, how do you do that and who's in charge? You know, that's going to always be the issue with with the sheriffs is, okay, whose jail is it and who's the sheriff, I've only been a sheriff for a short time, but the ones that have been around, such as Mr. Pierce, they are very opinionated.
Does leasing jail cells? I know Broome just leased jail cells in Tioga.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense if they build a $38 million jail over there, for example?
So I would have to ask Dave Harder, the sheriff in Broome, how that works. I surely can do that. He's a good friend of mine, and I can surely ask him how that works, and I'd be glad to do that.
Kind of interesting to see if we can come up with any kind of options to help on this board out issue.
Sure. Well, I know that Sheriff Yesman from Schuyler County recently contacted me and let us know, because obviously he's closer, and that his facility can be used by us. And I think he does take juveniles, right, Ray? I think. Yeah, but I think he does. But anyway, so he has offered that. So, just a little shorter distance for travel and things like that instead of Broome. But I can ask Dave and find out. I'd be glad to do that.
Anyone else? Ken, this is going to sound crazy, but a month or so ago, some reporter asked me about the expenditures for the cars in next year's budget. And it came to me that at that point, police around the country have been having a difficult time. Their image has, you know, been damaged in many different ways by things that have happened. And clearly here in Tompkins County, law enforcement people are you know, having difficulty also with an image, I think. And one of the things that has occurred to me, and maybe not to anyone else, I see a lot of really cool-looking black cars around with writing on it that if you hit it right with the light, it will show up brightly. And I think, and I see these rolling through neighborhoods, not only ours, but clearly the city of Ithaca. And I wonder what kind of a feeling people get from that. And where I'm going with this is I would like to see us, if we buy three or four cars, that we put out sheriff's cars that are marked clearly, red, white, and blue, black and white, whatever. I really do like the black cars that we have with the gold riding, the Fords, and some other things. I don't think we help ourselves very much, our image in the community, if we have cars that are, I guess I'll call them stealth cars.
And, well, if I could, Jim, I'll address
that. Absolutely.
Sure. All but one of our patrol vehicles, and when I say patrol, that is what the deputies drive, are black and gold. We have one stealth car that is on patrol, and that's the one with the plate reader, which most PDs tend to do, and that's what we did. The other ones that you see, which are tend to be SUVs that are stealth, those are our cars that are used by our sergeants, okay? They have no overhead, so that obviously cuts down on our cost. But with that being said, it was our choice to have our supervisors not drive the cars with the gold letters. So our patrol, our people that are dealing out there with the citizens in the community, for the most part, are in marked units, sir. And the only one that isn't, as I said, was a plate reader. If they deal with one of our sergeants, they'll be dealing with one with an SUV that does have the stealth writing on it. So that's how it's been set up and how we've done it. So.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Martha.
Wait, do you mean the black and gold? You're talking about the cars where you really can't see the writing.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. That's what they call stealth. Jim was right. They call those stealth cars. You can see them when the lights hit them in the dark because they're for safety reasons. So
you're saying only one of our cars is that?
One of our duty cars is just the one with the plate readers. Okay. But the other ones that you see, the SUVs,
those are
driven by our supervisors, our sergeant. Am I not correct? And also the other thing is, yes, we have also put the stealth writing on our corrections vehicles for obvious reasons. It's not necessary for the public to know that we're transporting prisoners in our CID or our corrections car. So, yeah, Ray just brought that to my attention. But as far as patrol is concerned and what Jim's expressing for concern, our patrol units are all marked except for the one with the plate reader. That's correct.
All right. Maybe I'm seeing the corrections ones because I'm around the courthouse.
Well, so. Yeah. I mean, the city of Ithaca has one or two, I believe, and I think one of them is their plate reader. There are other agencies that do have a stealth car. I'm not sure if Cougar Heights does any. I don't think they do, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Back to Peter's question about the equipment. So the Spillman, is like 3 years a typical lifespan? You're saying 3 years and you –
No, 5 years usually is what it tends to be the rule of thumb. But, you know, we don't replace them just because we think it's time to replace them. We don't replace them usually until they start to fail. That's how they're done. So all the cars that we get this year may not need to replace the equipment, but some of them will. I mean, we actually have to, when one breaks down now, we have to obviously either borrow from another source, which we really don't have that source. Or wait until we purchase a new car. But that's been the trend, correct, Sergeant Donahue? I mean, or Lieutenant, excuse me. I demoted you.
Sorry. Anyone else?
So these are computers that are breaking down?
The computers, yes. And we've had the keyboards that have to be replaced sometimes before the computers. So.
Okay. Is it particularly rough duty? I don't know. My computer is like 8 years old. I don't know.
But you don't have three shifts using it either.
Yeah. I mean, they're on pretty much almost 24/7. Not quite, but most.
Anyone else? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Solid waste. Chapter 4, page 283, no OTR request. Hello, Barbara.
I'm really actually very happy to be here. Joe knows why. I had surgery on my hand, and I thought because of an infection I developed, I'd be winding up back in the OR room instead of being here. So this is fantastic.
That would
no matter
probably,
what you say, I'll be happy.
Barbara, that would probably get you one OTR, the surgery on your hand. So
I'm cutting steps.
Think of
don't
one before you're done
it.
Here.
Yeah, don't no. worry about it. Okay. That's better. Okay. Basically, what I'll say to you in terms of this year, as we look into the budget for 2016 for solid waste, we've had a year of great program success and some serious budget challenges, and I'll be discussing that more. Okay. So what you'll notice here is that our expenditures have actually gone down as well as the total revenues that we're going to collect. And what I would like to do is just explain to you what's really going on here. The fact that we've actually been taking in less garbage tonnage is down, which in programmatic ways is a good thing because one would assume that we're actually being successful at what we're doing to divert waste. We're actually going to save money on the transfer and disposal, which accounts for about $150,000. Recycling, we didn't budget money in the equipment reserve because we've got a budget for the recycling center as well. We aren't going to pay out much for recycling to the businesses and Cornell because we're not expecting as much revenue. We are handling less tonnage at the composting, not to be concerned, but that's going to save us some money. We'll talk about staffing in a minute. We had plans to hire a fiscal coordinator when Tom Richardson retired, but the good news there is our principal account clerk typist has really risen to the occasion, asking me to hold off on that position, and she's really wowed us in a lot of ways. So that's, again, a savings. Old landfills, we've saved money on leachate hauling. Some of the miscellaneous things that we're saving money on, we're advertising less next year. We are not growing most of our programs. We are maintaining a very fiscal, conservative posture in a number of areas in terms of equipment, and just pretty much every line is either the same or it's going to go down. So that actually boils down to that savings there. So I don't want to get into a whole long song and dance. You guys have a pretty good understanding about the work we do, how we interact with the community, and how we really are very service and customer oriented. Of course, Jeff Dunn in his position as administrative coordinator and communications coordinator, the numbers are staggering in terms of how many people we serve, and how many events we go to, how many folks we reach out to. It's, certainly more than 20,000 a year. And we just have all kinds of really great communication strategies that are working. So basically, we really have two goals. One of our big successes has been with the food scrap recycling program. And what has been a success with that is the fact that not only have we removed a chunk of tonnage from the waste stream, but we have basically over 18,000 drops of food scrap from food scrap users that we're anticipating in 2015. Those numbers are growing in leaps and bounds, both at the recycling center and at the food scrap drop spots along with the pilot collection. We have a really good program. We have incredible participation and enthusiasm. That's going to turn out to be something very valuable. The costs keep going down as a result of the increases in participation. We were actually asked to speak at a national recycling conference, which is next week. I am going there to speak. I have a presentation that we put together along with my daughter's graphic design experience that I'm really excited to give. And we are giving a speech. I'm actually not, I don't have to pay anything for registration. It's fantastic. We were planning to go to the conference anyway. And, yeah, we have some really good models for the small city and for the more non-urban environments, which I think is going to be really good in our case. And that's important to me. I want to make sure that we serve all Tompkins County residents. There are There's 14 legislators, and we need to make sure all of the areas are being served, and we have to grow that concept. One of the big moves we're going to make with food scraps is we actually are going to we're investing, which was also in the budget, a mobile unit, so like a cargo trailer, and we're going to be going around like Doug's Fish Fry and adding drop spots so that we're able to reach more people. We're actually going to be doing some of that during the week, and we're going to continue in addition to some other locations. I know Village of Groton is one. There's even the judge expressed interest there, Glenn, and there's some good possibilities. But we're going to keep going, and if you know that there's any areas or any people that want to be served, we're ready to serve them. The other thing,
just so I know what you're talking about. Drop spots means where people can drop
their... A place where people can go and drop their food scraps into totes with toolkits provided at no charge by the county, which is a kitchen caddy, transportation container, 6 gallons, as well as biodegradable bags. And we have outreach assistants that are being paid a living wage, that are ready to serve. They're there to prevent contamination and answer questions. They're probably some of the most popular people in the county right now. The other program that we just started launching, Jeff's been really involved in this, is public space recycling. For all the good that we do in the community with our recycling program, we have a very poor presence in public spaces and a lot of the materials being thrown away. And by that I mean places that are typically outside where people, there might be a garbage can, but there isn't anything for recycling. So we launched two. We launched one at in conjunction with the public library in TCAT over by the library. They are well-constructed bins that have been tested. They have certain hole sizes to be able to put in garbage or recyclables. We're getting incredibly great response there, and that's been a success. There's actually a press release coming out where Susan Curry is going to give us a great quote about that. TCAT's very interested as well in other locations. So we're planning next year to add a few more of those and keep that moving. So let me talk about the financial woes. Our goal with solid waste, you know, for the last 25 years is to maintain what we call a 10% fund balance, which is different than what the county has as a whole, which is 5%, knowing that there could be risks in contamination from old landfills, recycling material prices not staying the same. And indeed, that's exactly what we talked about this trend last year. I went over my presentation about that, and we mentioned it in 2013. What is essentially going to happen this year is we're going to be losing somewhere in the neighborhood of $350,000 in recycling revenue. Did I change that? That slide never got changed. It's $350,000. I don't know what happened there. We submitted something and it never went in. But anyway, it's not a good situation. There are a lot of reasons for it. And the really sad truth about this is we had all the intention in the world, and Mike will remember because there hasn't been anybody in my position but me, that we thought and really assumed that when the debt was retired, there would be a savings and that we could see that the annual fee would go down. Now, we were able to take the annual fee down a few dollars last year, but not as much as we wanted. And this year, even with the reduction in our budget, with the, you know, the small cuts we made, we have not cut programs. We can't do that. And we are proposing, Joe and I, that annual fee has to be restored to the $56 a ton. The situation nationally, and I will be learning much more about it when I go to this conference, and there's people from, you know, all walks of recycling, the mills and all kinds of, you know, really people who know what they're talking about. The situation with the recycling markets, and I will show you some graphs. Hopefully they made it in the presentation. There were some graphs that were added. We'll see. Let me see. No, they didn't make it. Well, I don't know what happened. They were sent to Jenica. Yeah. Okay. The situation is that I'll just go over the information that since we started this contract in 2011, the average recycling revenue that the county was making was $73 a ton. Okay. And where it is now is it's about $31 a ton. So it's more than half. So while we were making about like $1.1 million a year, now we're only making, you know, in excess of $500,000, $600,000 at best. So that the way the haulers are dealing with it, because a lot of these haulers have their own recycling facilities, is they're charging for recycling, and anywhere in the neighborhood of $20 to $30 a ton, they're actually charging customers. And so, you know, the way we're addressing it is we're, in essence, charging customers through the annual fee that everybody pays, but we're not charging a gate fee, and that would probably erode the amount of material, and it would put a lot of that material back in the garbage. So unfortunately, you know, we really have a situation that is not happy, not at all. The other thing I wanted to make mention is, so to give you some idea, $1 on the annual fee is equal to about $50,000 in expenses, okay? That's the rough conversion. And that's important for the residents. All the other fees are being affected. The college fees are also going up. That's something I think that, you know, is important to note. And at this point, what I'm hearing, and I'm going to learn more, is we should see next year a slight rise, not anything that will restore these levels back to that high level we saw. In 2011, it was $72. 2012 was $50. 2013 was $50 as well. 2014 was about $47. And then 2015 projected is $31. So we're anticipating about a $37 revenue next year. But we have a number of constraints. We're not going to be increasing the disposal fee any higher because it does, if we charged more, then we would really influence the amount of tons we get, which are already decreasing. We have a lot of things working against us. As the garbage tonnage goes down, it's going to be hard, with costs being equal, to maintain that that disposal fee as well in future years. So We should be able to, based on other cuts that I'm making in this year's budget. We've been making cuts during this year, small ones, but making them, probably about $150,000 we've made so far this year on a $5.8 million budget. But I'm predicting we are going to meet the 10% fund balance for the year. With the changes that we're making, and the assumptions we're making in that slight revenue increase in the tonnages that we're anticipating, we should have a good chance of meeting the 10% fund balance by next year. If it looks like we're having more problems than we think, we're going to have to come back to the committee and we're going to have to look at some program changes to reduce that budget further. So that is our current situation. As far as staff, I made mention to you that the number of staff has gone down by one individual because we're not hiring the fiscal coordinator to replace the work that we had done before. It's being picked up both by the principal account clerk typist as well as the assistant office manager. So we have reduced by one position in our work. So that's the bigger picture here. I have not gone into desks and chairs and things of that sort in my presentation, but all that information is certainly in the budget.
Thank you. Questions for Barbara? Will, then Martha, and then Peter.
Barbara, thank you for all you do. I hope you're and being here despite your hand.
I'm doing great.
What is the sort of just on a global sense, what is happening in that market that's affecting?
What's interesting about it is at first it was due, when we started to see the decline, it was really due to the global recession and the economic downturn. It was due to the issues of the material being marketed to China and what was called the green fence. There was too much contamination in the material. A lot of the largest recycling companies, waste management, and Casella is by no means large, and some of the other companies really had to straighten out their act and get that material to be much cleaner. But in the last 2 years, it has had to do with the fact that a lot of this material, fiber and plastics, especially not the bottles and jugs, but the 1 through 7s and the rigid plastics have also gone to China. China's all set. They're already doing their own recycling now. They don't need the material. The other thing is, of course, they have a global recession. You know, they've got their own recession going on. But I'm still not really satisfied with what I'm hearing. It hasn't really completely resonated with me, because when you look at the material that we're marketing, we're marketing certain plastics to China, but we actually, with the help of Casella, have moved away from marketing our fiber to China to marketing our fiber domestically, which was one of my goals in terms of not feeding another economy, but feeding our own economy. And our material is going to a mill called Rock 10. So if indeed we're not being affected by China, why are those markets still struggling? And I'm going to do a full report on what the circumstances are after I get back, from learning from the heavy hitters what exactly is going on. I'll be asking an awful lot of questions as well. But this is a nationwide problem. Some places are actually a lot of the haulers, what they're doing is not only are they charging more at processing centers, but they are charging more to pick up recyclables from their customers. They don't have a situation like us where we have a contract with the private sector. It's not a free market, and we are able to control their price, so they have no room to move with any of our contracts at all.
As long as they last, presumably.
As long as
the contract period.
Right, as long as they last. But our contracts are good for another 5 years.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good.
Yeah.
Secondly, I mean, the one area that seems to be a real market is in terms of metals.
Metals is an interesting one, too. And I'm going to learn about that. We've seen a decline in the scrap metal market.
Really?
In the last 9 months. Probably only about a 20% decrease. And, yes, and not only that, the electronics have also gone down by about 30-35%. And the reason that the electronics are going down is once a lot of these mandatory programs, like in New York State, occurred, I don't know about nationally with electronics, but then all of a sudden, of course, the scrap deal, the electronic recycler said, oh, now they have to bring it to us, so we don't need to pay them as much, is the other thing. I'm much less concerned. I mean, we're probably going to lose 10,000 on scrap metal and 5,000 on electronics compared with you know, the other status. And, you know, I'm deeply disappointed because we brought that debt, that, you know, that debt service that we pay now is about 200,000 versus 800,000 that we were paying before. You know, we should have been able to do more last year, and we can't possibly, I mean, we, you know, we'll drive ourselves out of business if we don't adjust our fees, because we'll fall short of the 10% fund balance by at least $200,000 if we don't increase that fee back to where it was.
Thank you. Thank you.
Martha.
By the way, I think the county's fund balance is 10%.
That might have changed in the years I've been here. Sorry.
Yeah, I think so. To follow up Will's question, which actually was mine, is it possible that when we got started, nobody else was recycling, and we were, you know, not nobody else, but there are many more cities recycling and recycling more, and so it's just there's more of a glut on the market and not enough.
There's a glut on the Chinese market. There isn't as much demand for the product in a time when there isn't a lot of manufacturing being done compared to what it was before. I mean, you look at cardboard, for example. Cardboard production was quite a bit, orders of magnitude higher 5 to 10 years ago than it is now. I mean, you do remember that we had, at one point, a 17% fund balance here. And there was concern, you know, we had too high a fund balance, and I was able to say, you never know what's going to happen. And I didn't know what was going to happen. Nobody could have predicted, you know, the severity to which the decline resulted. I can tell you that the Casella revenues are above what's called the official board markets, which are the standard measurement for highs and lows in the market. So they've been reliable.
Thank you.
Peter.
Quick question. With the food scraps, what's the ultimate use for them, or where do they end up?
So what happens to the food scraps, and I didn't bring a bag of the sample for all of you. I probably could. The food scraps turn into a very top-notch soil material that aids landscapers, both commercially and residentially, as well as now we're doing projects with soil erosion control, stormwater runoff management, and all kinds of, you know, potential highway applications. We actually applied, working together with the Soil Water Conservation District, for a grant through the Consolidated Funding Application for a whole bunch of other uses. The uses are growing. It's now being sold by the bag this year, and being distributed throughout the county at over 20 locations. They've had tremendous sales. They really are, I've used them, and we've got not just little gardens, but I have fields of potatoes and onions and tomatoes and things, and unbelievable response from how well this stuff is actually working. Hugo Compost just said, sorry.
I didn't understand. When you collect the food scraps, then You just sell them someplace else?
No. The food scraps go to our contracted partner, Cuga Compost in Trumansburg. We have a contract with them. They have a DEC permit to process in these windrows with some equipment that we got through a grant to turn the material, and over time, it's about a 90-day period, the material is mixed with yard waste, and it turns into a finished product, which looks just like a soil amendment, and it has great nutrients in it, and it's a resource.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Mike?
I understand. I get it about commodities, and we're in a bad time. Ever since we began this, year to year, watched the commodities go up and down. Some years we've had good prices, and I'm not telling you anything, and sometimes we've had bad. But last year we reduced the solid waste fee because the bonds were paid off, and we were, to some extent, as you pointed out, keeping a promise that had been made. And now, only 1 year later, we're going back on that promise by raising the solid waste fee by $4. I can't say that pleases me as a resident or as a legislator a lot. I also have a problem, and Peter was on this, on the food scrap processes. How much do we pay? Because nobody pays us for those food scraps. It's not a commodity. We're paying somebody else to process them.
Yeah, that's
right?
Just one of our many programs provide, but let me help you with that.
How much are we paying to run the food scrap processing every year?
$45 a ton is our cost for the processing.
Well, how much is that total in a year?
It's about 100. Well, it depends on the tonnage, but for let's just say it's 2,000 tons. Okay, 2,000 tons times 45. That's about what, 120,000 a year.
Okay.
So that's approximately $2.50 on the annual.
So that's.
$2.50 on the annual fee.
$2.50 on the annual fee that we are just paying out because we're really not getting anything back.
That's correct.
On that. So I just want to
no different than household hazardous waste collection, which we're also paying about the same amount of money.
But we got some grants to get that one started, as I recall.
We got it started, but the amount of money has decreased over time. There will be, you know, that's one of the pushes right now that I'm working with at the state level, and I'm getting attention. You know, when we got started with recycling, there was state money available for buying, you know, for doing these things. And there is no money, no mandates yet, but no money available from the state. So if we're going to continue in our mission to, you know, to do these things, which clearly all over the country, food scraps produces the most greenhouse gas emissions of all waste. It represents 25% to 30% of the waste stream, and we have set some goals, then it behooves us to continue. Now, there are different ways to go about it. The drop spot approach happens to be very inexpensive compared with other places that are doing the curbside collection all over the county. We're going to be working with best management practices over this year. We are already working with haulers to integrate service on a voluntary basis for, you know, it could be for the cost of a tag or it could be whatever. But we have an obligation as part of our, you know, we've got about 20 or 25 programs to reduce waste. We go in, we provide the businesses with a program to reduce waste because, again, they're paying an annual fee. We have citizens that are applauding the efforts to reduce waste. So if we're going to continue in the business of providing economical solutions, and $45 a ton pales in comparison to the $85 a ton cost for disposal, then my recommendation is to move forward with it, but do it slowly, which is exactly what we're doing, because, you know, right now we're probably only doing about 5-8% of the waste stream through you know, diverting the food scraps. We could go hog wild, but we don't have the money to do that, and nor does it make sense. But I think that unless we're going to change what we have said we're doing as a county to reduce the solid waste, we need to stay on course.
One more question. But so what's the game plan to get the solid waste fee back down in the future? What will trigger reducing it? Or do we just get it up there and continue to do more and more and spend more?
All of these are very good questions.
I know they're good questions.
If I've thought about it a lot,
right.
And I'm not retiring for 5 years, so it's my problem. What we have to do is, you know, again, there has to be pressure on state government to take responsibility for providing municipalities with help with infrastructure. The other thing, remember, is that we have applied for, through the grant we got, the municipal recycling grant process, for a number of costs with our recycling program, including now we're able to get 50% cost share on, you know, the drop spots and things of that sort. They said at one point it was going to be 3 years for reimbursement, then they said 5 years, and now they're holding $790,000 of our dollars hostage, that it's going on 7 years now. That's really where we need to see change, because $790,000 distributed over 5 years will lower the annual fee substantially.
So the game plan is to hopefully have the state give us some money to reduce.
Well,
the fee.
I think that we need to put some added pressure on the state in whatever form that, you know, this legislature is good at. I'm doing the best I can working with the top dogs at the DEC, but again, you know, the fact that they have made these They haven't made promises. They have made commitments. And that, you know, had we known that they were going to take 7+ years, we wouldn't have made the commitments that we've made.
Well, I would just point out, and it's not your department, but they were going to pay a big chunk of our emergency radio system, and they didn't do that. So
we did get the $1.2 million on the capital money. We do have a grant right
thank
now.
Thank you. Thank you for your responses.
No, it's a real serious problem.
Martha, go ahead, please.
I think the short answer is why are we spending $45 for compost that somebody else turns around and makes money on? We're spending $45 for that material to be taken away instead of spending $85 to have it taken away as garbage. That's $40 a ton in opportunity costs. And then
that's the gist of it. There was another answer also, Mike. The truth of the matter is, if these revenues continue to decline, I'm going to come to you with program cuts. I will be honest. I will have to do that. That is, it wouldn't be responsible to do it any other way.
Peter Stein, and then Dan.
I don't need to ask
a question. Okay, Dan, go ahead.
I know you've mentioned a potential to develop a fats, oil, and grease program as part of the food scrap. Is there a potential revenue in that?
Yeah, that's going to happen. We do have the funds available that have been set aside in, you know, with finance for that the current food scrap little area at our recycling center is going to improve that, and the FOG, the fats, oils, and grease, will be part of that, a very nominal cost.
Saleable item, though?
Yeah. The goal is going to be to work with the treatment plant so that the material can be, first it's going to go there and get digested into energy, and then they're also trying to work with, you know, in terms of biodiesel. Yep.
Anyone else? Thank you both.
You're very welcome.
Up next, probation, community justice. It is Chapter 4, page 244. No OTR requests.
Hello, everyone. I'm Pat Buchel, Director of Probation. This is Ujjal Mukherjee. He's my budget guru. He knows where every single penny is in this budget, so if you have any questions, he can certainly answer any questions you have about budget lines. Do I press enter? So if I had one word to describe the budget for probation for 2016, it is stability. If you look at this first slide, the recommended budget, you'll basically see that stability reflected there. Some of the percentage changes have to do with the adjusted rates with respect to the pension. For the revenue line, the -5.57 2016 recommended shows a reduced figure. That's because we are expecting some revenues to come in the form of some grants. We have the ignition interlock device grant that we receive. We receive funding through DSS, through the STSJP funding, and also we are the host site for the PART grant. Again, stability, full-time equivalents, no change. We do expect a retirement coming next year, but that doesn't affect anything at this point. And because everything is so stable, I know this is like not very dramatic presentation, but our caseload numbers are stable. Our workload is stable. I mean, it's not to say that we don't have some fluctuations in the workload. That's normal, but on average, everything is pretty stable in terms of the workload. So it's very refreshing to be able to come to you for the first time in my history as Director of Probation with no request for an OTR, and it feels pretty good on my end. I hope it feels good on your end as well. There were a couple things, though, that I've labeled as future unknowns that I wanted to share with you, because these are things that could be coming down the pike that may affect my future budget. One is the Raise the Age legislation. So this refers to raising the age of criminal responsibility from age 16 to 18. There have been several draft versions of legislation to support that increase in the age, but nothing has transpired yet. There is a lot of support. I know Governor Cuomo is in support of this. I think it's coming down the pike. When exactly, I don't know. What this would do, raising the age, would result in all 16 and 17-year-olds being issued a JD appearance ticket. So currently, 16 and 17-year-olds are charged as adults, and they are required to report to the criminal court in which they've allegedly committed their crime. So now that focus and shift would then come to the probation department, and we would be working with all 16 and 17-year-olds. Of course, we'll have to wait and see what the draft legislation shows and requires us to do, but most likely it will be us requiring and performing diversion services and intake services for these 16 and 17-year-olds. So that could mean, obviously, an increase in workload for the probation department. I want you to know that the Council of Probation Administrators have really been very voice loud in our voice about making sure that there's 100% funding associated with any legislation that comes forward for raising the age. So we make our voice heard. We're demanding that that be the case, and that was promised in the last version of the legislation, but I guess we're going to have to wait and see. So that's the first one. And the second future unknown, that which could affect future budget, is the Ithaca Community Treatment Court. I think everyone's aware that Judge Wallace took over that court effective January of this year. And he is in the process, along with the team. They're really looking at reshaping and restructuring that program. They've been doing a lot of good work on that. I really firmly believe that once they've gotten their feet on the ground with it, that the growth potential for participants, I think it could explode. Right now, the caseload size is doable, but I do foresee some expanding program numbers with that. And I have one full-time senior probation officer assigned to that caseload. In the old days, we used to have three full-time senior probation officers. That's how much the program was reduced over the years. So I anticipate that there may be growth in that area. And that is my presentation.
Questions for Patricia?
Yes.
Martha, and then Peter, and then Mike.
Pat, I am. It is a little weird to not have you have unmet needs, I guess. So I am number one. I yesterday at the alternative to CJA ATI. Alternatives to Incarceration Board, we heard from you and Deb Dietrich about the reentry subcommittee, the study. So I know, and I understand you're going to be coming to the Public Safety Committee in 2 weeks and the next legislature meeting to talk about that. So that's talking about a response to past events, but I know it's new program ideas. So I'm just sort of telegraphing that for folks. But about current stuff, we keep hearing from the Sheriff's Department about increasing numbers, about so many people, you know, the jail is just stuffed and they're so busy. And we hear up on the news all about, you know, drug issues and, you know, epidemic of drug, especially drug problems with people. So how are your caseloads stable?
Well, when I say stable, feel right. I mean the numbers are stable. Are we seeing an increase in people coming through the doors with opiate addictions? Yes. But we're not seeing an increase in supervision assignments.
Are you saying opiate addiction is replacing other things that people used to be in trouble for.
Yes.
Okay. So overall, your caseloads are saying not having.
Yeah.
That just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, you know, I think part of the stability, I think, is that we're also doing a better job with our risk and needs assessment and in assessing those cases that need probation supervision, number one. And I think if you look across the state, supervision numbers are down across the state as well. So I think probation departments as a whole are doing a better job in recommending appropriate cases for probation. I think sometimes in the past when we were just using our judgment, we might recommend probation for someone where a conditional discharge is maybe more appropriate. So I think we're doing a better job in making better recommendations for people. So I don't think we're seeing as many people come on supervision because we're making those better judgments and better decisions about this person really doesn't need supervision. They can be self-monitored in the community with a conditional discharge. So I think that's part of it. I think that's made a huge impact in making appropriate recommendations.
Okay.
All right, that's my assessment of it.
Peter.
Yeah, a couple of questions. With that slide that's up there, I never heard of the Ithaca Community Treatment Court. What's the previous name of that?
Ithaca Community Treatment Court.
Really? That's what it's always been?
Yeah. We have Felony Drug Court for felony cases, and then we have the Ithaca Community Treatment Court for the misdemeanor cases.
Is that the Family Treatment Court?
No.
No. Huh.
Ithaca Community Treatment Court operates out of Ithaca City Court.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So what's the restructuring going on there?
Well, I think they're looking at the referral process, how cases are coming in, which cases are appropriate, which cases aren't. I think cases, there were in the past cases that were lingering for a long period of time. I think they're working towards moving cases through the process faster and more appropriately. I think that there's been some changeover in the team in terms of personnel, so I think they're just trying to regroup as a team. I know that they want to do better outreach to the local courts outside the city of Ithaca because they can transfer cases into Ithaca City Court, cases that are appropriate for the intensive monitoring. So I really do think that once once they're done. They're making really good strides, and we're really very pleased with Judge Wallace, and he's got the empathy and the compassion and the consistency needed for that program. So I'm feeling that the numbers could potentially increase.
Okay. An observation I remember hearing a couple of years ago when this first discussion of raising the age of youth, that was going to cost a lot of money for the jail, because then there would have to be three classifications, not two anymore. That you were going to have to segregate people into under 16, 16 to 17, and then over 17.
Well, with raising the age, Peter, 16 and 17-year-olds wouldn't be going to jail, so it actually should help the jail.
Not as a sentence, but when they're being held there in jail.
No, they wouldn't go to jail. They would go to detention. It would be a totally different approach.
Okay.
Yeah. So that should help the jail class.
I see. Okay. And let's see. I had another question. Give me a second. In your new quarters, your beautiful new quarters for day reporting, I remember, I haven't been involved in that for a while, but I remember that the miserable looking quarters in the old building sort of limited what you can do. Are there any other, are you able to expand in some way the programs that are going to go on in day reporting?
First of all, I do want to point out that we have moved. I hope you've all received your invitation to the open house October 5th from 3 to 5. If you can't make that time and you would still like to be able to see, please call me and we can set up an individual time for me to tour you through. The facility, the new, we can't say enough about how beautiful it is. Even the clients are just, oh, my God, this is so beautiful. And I think I was just mentioning to Martha that I really expect that we're just going to see tons of positive things with clients in that environment. I don't think they can believe they're in such a beautiful location, and I really think it'll totally affect their attitude. I walked over the other day, and everybody was, it was just such a great scene. They were in the classroom, and there was instruction going on, and they were all just rapt and paying attention and just sitting around this beautiful new table, and really, really pleased. So, in terms of expansion, there are some things that I have been thinking about. Those two classroom spaces obviously would be great sites to do our Thinking for a Change curriculum for evidence-based practice, and also our Ready, Set, Work with our employment specialist, which is a pre-employment curriculum. So obviously those classrooms will be used. And then Martha did mention the reentry and transitional services. Deb Dietrich and I co-chaired that subcommittee. We've completed our report. We presented the report to CJATI this week, and we are on the agenda for public safety, followed by the legislature presentation on the same day, October 6th, yes. So you can learn more there, but, I've had thoughts in the back of my head that day reporting space could be a potential good use for some reentry and transitional services and some programming. So it's a perfect location. It's a perfect classroom-style setting. So I'm thinking about those things, yes.
Well, good luck.
Well, thank you, Peter.
Mike and then Martha.
Congratulations on the move to the new building. And I thank Patricia Carey. I thank you and your staff for bearing with us during construction. That was important. Your comment you just made is so apropos. It's important when we have folks in the criminal justice system, in our social services system, that they have good facilities that send the message to them that they matter.
Yes.
And because when they're put in depressing circumstances, then it just adds to the depression of their tough lives,
yes,
frankly.
Yes, I agree.
But I wanted to ask about the proposed state legislation, and I think Peter hit on it a little, but If we get a 16 or 17-year-old charged with a serious crime and needs to go to detention, where do we put those people? Where is detention? There isn't any around very much anymore, is there?
No, that's a good question. So
how much will that cost?
That's going to involve some transport for sure. Yeah.
Where would we have to, if we got one today, where would we send that person?
I think there's the closest is maybe Syracuse, Hillbrook Detention, I believe. I'm not sure if that's our catchment area. But yeah, it's not. There's nothing local.
Yeah. I think that's
so it does kind of help with the jailed bed, but not necessarily transportation. I know the Sheriff's Association had some issue with raise the age because of the transportation part of it. You know.
Thanks.
Yes.
Martha.
Pat, remind me the hours for their reporting right now.
They have to be there no later than 10 to 9, and we end at 1:30.
10 of 9 to 1:30.
Yeah, but people usually come earlier and, you know, to check in.
Okay. And about how many clients do you have on average right now?
Anywhere from 12 to 15.
So, and the magistrates, you're going to invite and, you know, walk through this?
Absolutely. Everybody got the invitation.
All right. Terrific. Thanks. And parole, too.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. They got invited, too.
Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Up next, TC Action, Chapter 5, page 50, no OTR.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I told them that. No, thank you for that. Good evening. I just go.
Good evening.
Go.
You're on.
We're here. I want to introduce Carrie Berman, our CFO, Deputy Director, is going to join in the presentation this evening. We're pleased to accept the generous support from the legislator to support the constituents with very low incomes in our county. This is recommended. We brought some major influences tonight, some stuff that's happened over the last year. 19 programs and 105 staff serve 6,513 individuals. I think that's a pretty big number. You guys can read. I'll let you read that for a second.
What's non-governance activities?
Not on the board of directors. Parent activity groups, tenant activity groups. Policy council.
Are we praying? Huh? Are we praying?
We're reading.
Oh.
We don't have any OTRs tonight, but we thank you for your support in the past and look forward to our successful collaboration with Tompkins County. We have a food pantry. We're a partner of the Food Distribution Network of Tompkins County. In 2014, we distributed 5,721 boxes of food through 1,800 household visits. 196 volunteers donated 809 hours to program and governance activities. These two gentlemen are volunteers from Cargill. Cargill volunteers have continued their commitment to the TC Action Victory Garden since 2011 when we started it. The Victory Garden, on May 22nd and 23rd, we held our fifth annual Victory Garden giveaway to over 180 households with limited incomes. The results are amazing. Returning gardeners become volunteers and mentors. Children are eating vegetables they've never eaten before, and people are learning skills to last them a lifetime. The vegetable seedlings and beautiful hanging baskets that you see in this slide are all donated by the Horticulture Department of Cornell University. We've worked with Professor Neil Mattson and his team since we started this in 2011. Seedlings. Over 9,000 vegetable seedlings were distributed to participants of TC Action programs and to local community gardens. Sustainable Tompkins made possible a tool lending library, so to speak, this year. Home Depot and Lowe's donated buckets for container gardens, and Cayuga Compost donated soil for those containers. Carrie, you're on.
Bring the microphone over to you, Carrie.
How's that? Is that good?
There's one closer to you.
Take that one right in front of you. Yeah.
How's that?
That's fine. Go ahead.
Okay. We just completed our first year of two in a collaboration with the Science Center. They secured a grant from the National Library and Museums to enhance science education and funded training our Head Start and Early Head Start teachers. We matched some of those funds with our grant funds to expand that to include our parents. The curriculum is implemented into our classroom. Twice a month, we do a training with parents. We provide childcare for the first half, and the Science Center trains parents on activities. They come together, they have a meal, and then the children join with their parents or guardians and do the activities together. This is all linked into the classroom. The units like feathers and magnets and water are also linked to our literacy. So there are books that are going home to the home family library linked to these activities that are going on each month. And we're excited to have another year, and it's been very successful. And it has increased our family's activities at the Science Center. Harvest Dinners. We're third year of Harvest Dinners, which are linked to our Lana Nutrition Enhancement. And there is a vegetable or fruit every single month that's integrated into the food that we're serving in our program. Twice a month, families come and cook family dinners together. We provide child care while families are cooking together, and then children join with their families and have dinners. And we do this twice a month as well. So I thought I'd talk about Casey Center, because you all are an integral part of our expansion at Casey Center. The blue up top is the original building, and last year we built the addition, which is the second part, adding three classrooms and creating two new early Head Start classrooms for which you generously supported the funding of hiring teachers. We also converted Amici House, another site we have, to early Head Start. So we had six new early Head Start teachers, four of which are former Head Start parents who started with us as support aides, then became classroom assistants, teacher assistants. Our grant provides for tuition and mentoring dollars for Head Start parents. Currently, our agency has 22% of our staff started out as Head Start parents. Currently, our Head Start and Early Head Start program director is a former Head Start parent, as is the director of the Office of Head Start in Washington. She's also a former Head Start parent. This is our one-year-old classroom for Early Head Start, and then they will move. from this classroom to this classroom right next door, which is two-year-olds. In the early Head Start model, the teachers transition with the children, so they spend the first 2 years with the same staff. And then when they graduate, they move down the hallway and join into Head Start. And so children at Casey Center will stay there for 3 or 4 years. And then in their last year, they'll go across the street to the elementary school, where we have a collaborative UPK pre-K classroom with Dryden Elementary. And then from there, they graduate to kindergarten. So not only are children building long-term relationships with other children and teaching staff, but so are families. And they're an integral part of a site that is similar to a small school. And we're seeing a lot of strong outcomes. And not only are children ready for school, but so are their parents, which, of course, we all know enhances the child's outcome. Dryden Dairy Days. We have been participating in Dryden Dairy Days for about 16 years in the parade. Every year, our kids and our parents do a theme. And this year, this was our theme. And for the 14th year in a row, we have won an award at the Dryden Dairy Days. I think this year, their award was $75, maybe $50. And so families at the center will plan and create a family event using those funds with everyone at the site.
Now back to me. This slide shows the entrances of Magnolia House, Corn Street, and the backyard of Chartwell, sort of in that order, 320 Magnolia, Corn Street, and then closest to me is the backyard of Chartwell. Magnolia House opened this year, and our first tenant moved in August. Well, it opened last year, didn't it? And our first tenant moved in on August 1st, 2014. Eligible participants are women in recovery from substance and alcohol abuse, experiencing homelessness, pregnant or with a child under five. Supportive housing for families includes 6 apartments at our 2 residents at the corner of Cleveland and Corn in the city of Ithaca. And we also have 6 transitional units scattered across Tompkins County that we rent and then lease to the families. Chartwell House has been open since 2000 and serves up to 12 single men at any given time who are also active in their recovery from substance abuse and also have been experiencing homelessness. Recently, we integrated Head Start and Early Head Start programming in all our supportive housing sites when appropriate. Our Housing Choice Voucher Program, formerly called Section 8, served 1,120 households with rental assistance in fiscal year 2014, upgrading Tompkins County housing stock with our housing quality standards inspections and annual subsidies to local landlords to the tune of $6,675,470. Through the Housing Choice Voucher Program, we deliver a family self-sufficiency program, which is a voluntary employment program that allows Housing Choice Voucher participants to develop a type of savings account that becomes theirs at graduation of the program. Graduation means a year free of cash assistance from the Department of Social Services and 1 year of full-time employment. People often use this for down payment for a home. Go to school, pay off some debts, buy a car. The program also includes a home ownership option, which began in TC Action in 2002. To date, 28 homeowners have purchased homes, and more than half of those homeowners no longer receive assistance. When we met the folks who joined the Family Self-Sufficiency Program before they got to this point, those 28 people, they had incomes of less than 100% of poverty. So it's 28 homes may not seem a lot, but for folks who have started out with literally nothing, I think it's pretty incredible. Our energy program, since 1977, we have assisted homeowners and renters to reduce energy expenses and reduce their carbon footprints. Our objective is to improve the health, safety, and energy efficiency of homes throughout Tompkins County by providing a formal, comprehensive, in-depth assessment of buildings and then addressing energy efficiency deficiencies with a group of programs based on household income, weatherization, Empower New York, assisted home performance, Green Jobs, Green New York, and our very own fee-for-service program called Building Energy Solutions, or BESS. Plans for the future. The Tompkins Ithaca Continuum of Care has identified two top housing priorities, housing for chronically homeless singles and housing for independent youth ages 16 to 25 years of age. We are working on both those projects right now. One is a supportive rooming house model for singles, men and women, with common kitchen, laundry, bathrooms, living areas, and supportive services. The other project is a supportive housing program for youth, 16 to 25 years of age, 20 studio apartments, and possibly a couple two-bedroom apartments for larger families. We hope to provide early Head Start classrooms in the building, along with a commercial kitchen training space and staff offices. We are also very excited about our participation at 210 Hancock Street. 210, is that right? It will include three early Head Start classrooms when funded. INHS has just applied again for tax credits, and we're very hopeful that that will come to fruition this year. That's our presentation tonight.
Questions. Let me ask the first one. The Copper Building on Meadow Street, how many people live there, or is it apartments?
It's 14 studios. And all but four, so that would be 10 of the women there have children under the age of five.
Dumb question number two. You don't pay property taxes. Are you all exempt on?
We are a 501c3 nonprofit charitable organization.
So how many different properties do you own around the county?
We own Chartwell House, Corn Street 7.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Someone else? Go ahead.
So Chartwell, Corn, and Magnolia, how long do people stay there?
Those three properties are all permanent housing. We don't know yet about Magnolia. Generally, people stay between 18 to 24 months. At 1 year, because we have project-based vouchers. We've applied for and have been given project-based vouchers for each one of the units. So project-based vouchers, different than tenant-based vouchers, stay with an apartment. If you have gotten, which we have, the authority to have project-based vouchers at your supportive housing sites, after a year of responsible tenancy, not owing us any money, not trashing the apartment, you can move with a portable voucher onto other permanent housing.
Okay, but first you said permanent, and then you said 18 to 24 months.
People can stay as long as they want.
Stay as long as they want.
But they don't generally stay as long as... We have a couple guys at Chartwell that will probably stay there for the rest of their lives.
Okay. As part of this reentry subcommittee, you heard me... I think you were in the room when I asked Pat Buchel about it. One of the very biggest needs in terms of people coming out of our jail is housing. It's like they did a survey of inmates, and more than half of them had no idea where they're going to live when they get out. So these facilities are terrific, but it seems like they get filled and then they're filled, or maybe somebody moves out every 2 years. Is there any capacity for more transient, transitional, but supportive housing to really try to move people? Because we have a constant flow and a roadblock in terms of where they can go. And maybe I'm thinking these transitional units that are scattered sites might be the best answer, maybe requires more supervision because people are scattered. But is there a way TCA can help with an issue that has bothered me for a long time. We have these great programs, but they get filled right away.
Well, I'm taking them one at a time. I'm participating in, I'm not part of the subcommittee, reentry subcommittee, but I have been to several sessions of the Multicultural Resource Reentry, URO, collective impact stuff. Certainly, I think that the probably the singles that we're proposing for probably targeting the chronically homeless, but certainly would be a place that someone coming out of jail or prison could land for a moment, get resources, benefit assessments, and then move on. It's a little complicated. Housing funders want you to build permanent housing. We're a small county. We don't have a lot of people. So my dream involves larger numbers because it's very expensive to staff these programs. So my formula that TC Action has been using for quite some time is the project-based vouchers plus some HHAP, which is a mortgage that we have for 25 years, but we don't have to pay it back as long as we're doing homeless housing. So we're just looking at staffing and operations, repairs, maintenance, and the project-based vouchers make that happen. When you're working with very vulnerable populations, they tend not to stay compliant with Department of Social Services. But the bills keep coming. So you're getting nothing for rent while this person is trying to figure out how to get SSI or get back into DSS or get a job. And if you've been, you know, drinking for 40 or 50 years, sometimes that takes a little while. So it's very hard to do something without the project-based vouchers. And that requires permanent housing designation. That doesn't mean that we have turnover quite a bit. At Chartwell House, there's at least three or four rooms, but you're right, they fill up immediately. We need more housing.
Okay, well, this is a much longer conversation, so I look forward to your being part of it.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Anyone else? Thank you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We are back here on September 28th at 5:30. BOE, Finance, Health, Mental Health, Rural Library, Youth Services, County Attorney, and the DA. And if anyone hasn't given their money to Kathy, who are here, please do that.